BSI in the world, I'm John Batchelor. Gaza conflict. Hezbollah threat from the north. I go to the headlines out of London before joining Bill Raggio of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies and Seth Franzman for the Jerusalem Post and the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Starmer, that's the leader of the opposition, expected to be the next prime minister in the United Kingdom. Starmer, Israel's invasion of Rafah must not go ahead. Headline, Israel tells 100,000 people to leave eastern Rafah ahead of ground invasion. Headline, Israel threatens imminent Rafah invasion if ceasefire talks collapse. Headline, pro-Palestine demonstrators spat and spewed anti-Semitic remarks at counter-protesters. Headline, Green Party investigates counselor who shouted Allahu Akbar. That's London. I welcome Seth from Jerusalem, looking at the situation in the South and the North. We begin in the South because Seth's most recent report pointed to a conversation between the Minister of Defense, Yoav Gallant, in Israel, and the Secretary of Defense, looking at the possibilities that are upon us. Seth, a very good evening to you. I begin with Gaza, an imminent operation in Rafah. Eastern Gaza, we're told, has been told to evacuate. Help the audience understand who've never been there. What does that mean, Seth? Good evening to you.
Good evening to you. Well, basically, Rafah is a pretty big city on the border with Egypt. It's in the southern part of Gaza, and it has some suburbs around it. Obviously, it's been swelled by lots of people who fled fighting in the north after the Hamas attack on October 7th. So the city of what used to be several hundred thousand or so, they say it may have up to 1 million people. And some of those people, you know, are internally displaced. They've gone back to the north. But Israel has been talking about, you know, going into Rafah for a long time because Rafah is kind of the last Hamas major stronghold. There's lots of tunnels that are thought to be there, probably weapons manufacturing as well. So Israel started today by basically calling for several neighborhoods in eastern Rafah, which is the area of Rafah closest to the Israeli border, to basically evacuate and go to a humanitarian zone, which is not that far away. They basically have to move a few miles, not very far. So that's 100,000 people they estimate, and Israel would like to start its operation slowly there. It's not entirely clear if this is to pressure Hamas or if this is actually the real operation to dismantle Hamas. So there's a lot of question marks about what comes next and how it will be carried out. Israel's been talking about this operation for months, and Israel hasn't really put together a clear plan or strategy or tactic on how it wants to do it.
Bill, you have a question for Seth.
Yes, Seth. I read a report over the weekend that Israeli officials do claim that they had given a strategy for the operation in Gaza. And then there's been another report that the U.S. has withheld a shipment of military aid to Israel, but there was no reasons given. Is this all related to the operation in Gaza? Is the Biden administration putting pressure on Israel to halt this operation, which is needed in order to defeat Hamas?
I think there's a lot of balls in the air. I think that the Biden administration has been clear that they basically kind of oppose this unless they are presented with a plan that they kind of like. Israel has talked about different plans, but I don't think it's really sketched it out. And that's because of the problematic nature of the way the war is being run in general, which is that the IDF military brass has different ideas about the war than the defense ministry sometimes. And both of them have different ideas than the prime minister's office and some of the people in the coalition or the war cabinet. So it's very complicated. Now, the story about the munitions popped up over the weekend, I think first at Axios, now it's also at The Hill and other places. I think that story requires a bit more confirming of exactly what, where, why, and how, because if some munitions were supposed to come here, but the process by which they were getting to Israel was stopped by mistake, or because there aren't enough of the munitions or something, it's a lot different than if it's a sensitive munition that's actually required for something that is purposely being stopped. And I think there's a big difference there, and it requires, you know, the right people to look at it, because the pictures with the article were 155 millimeter artillery shells, which are in short supply globally because of the Ukraine war and also because of the Gaza war. There's a lot, you know, but if you have 155 military millimeter shells don't win a war. So if Israel doesn't have enough of them, that's probably okay for now. But I just think it's have to be very careful on whether this is messaging or leaks or whether it's an actual thing that means that, you know, Israel doesn't get enough of the munitions. So far, I think we're not seeing that detail being confirmed, that Israel's really not getting something it really needs.
Seth, your colleague at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, Jonathan Shanzer, you know him well, over these last weeks has mentioned, without an ability to confirm until, mentioned the possibility that there are tunnels open underneath the Philadelphia line into Sinai and always have been open, a source of reinforcement, material smuggling, and that those tunnels might still be open, known to some parts of the Egyptian apparatus, but not all. Those tunnels would provide an exit for Hamas. So I'm puzzling. Do we have confirmation that Hamas is still underneath Rafah in those tunnels? Or have they evacuated? Have you heard anything pointing towards Hamas in Sinai?
I haven't heard anything about that. There's no doubt that Hamas would have, you know, can have agents or people it talks to. But I think Hamas, the narrative or the way Hamas is posturing, Hamas thinks it's winning the war. Hamas has very, very powerful friends in very high places, including in Ankara and Turkey and Doha and Qatar. These are two Western allies. It's backed by Iran. It's backed by Russia. It's backed by China. If you were Hamas, why would you leave? I mean, they feel that they have a winning hand. Also, let's remember, Israel has given them a way out of Rafah that's not through tunnels. Israel has basically removed Israeli forces from the rest of Gaza, except for an air corridor. All Hamas has to do is wander north of Rafah into what is Khan Yunis, where the Hamas leadership is from. And by the way, Khan Yunis, part of it now is part of the quote-unquote humanitarian zone. So I don't see why Hamas would leave. You know, they might have been scared in the beginning, but I don't see why they would suddenly think that Israel is going to change the tactics that Israel has not changed for 15 years or something more like that. So, you know, Hamas is from there. I think they don't, only the leaders would only leave if they got a direct order from their handlers and their hosts and the real leadership that lives abroad. All the big honchos live in Qatar or they jet set around the region. So that would be the only way that Sinwar and these and his henchmen would leave. And I don't see why they would leave now. They think they've done pretty well.
Bill, you have a question.
Yes, Seth, tomorrow will be the 8-month anniversary of Hamas's horrific attack on Israel. Do you think that Israel has a winning war strategy with respect to Hamas based on what you've witnessed in these last 8 months?
I think it's 7 months, but...
7 months, my apology.
I hope so. I think that from what I've witnessed, Israel has the military capabilities to destroy and dismantle this organization in every way, shape, or form. Israel currently has not put in place the other side of that, which is some sort of provisional authority or civil authority that's willing to do the rest of the job, which is to send to kind of bring in an outside force or bring in the Palestinian Authority or bring in someone else to run things and, you know, do some sort of de-Hamasification or denazification, whatever you want to call it. So unfortunately, Israel is fighting a very tactical level operation in which generally Israel wins every battle because Hamas either disappears or disbands its battalions, or when they try to stand and fight, they lose very quickly. And they've lost a lot of their capabilities in terms of long-range rocket fire. But we can see how quickly they're rebuilding because this week, for instance, or over the last 5 days, Hamas carried out, along with like four other terrorist groups, kind of semi-coordinated attacks against the Netzarim corridor, which is a corridor the IDF controls near Gaza City. They didn't kill any people, I don't think, but they showed the ability to coordinate a bunch of attacks. And then yesterday, Hamas fired 10 projectiles that are this 114-millimeter rockets that they've been using against an IDF post at Kerem Shalom. That's a post that is near a civilian community. Hamas had been watching the post. They apparently gathered intelligence on it from watching it, and they were able to then, you know, kill several soldiers and wound a bunch of them. So, you know, you have to imagine this group is smart. It has the ability to regrow its tentacles. It's being advised by very smart people that helped to build up the Hezbollah military machine and the Iranian military machine and all sorts of other things. So it can be defeated, but there is not as yet a political, military strategic will to do that. So I think as we're all familiar with, you know, any military strategy or Clausewitz or just history in general, you can win lots of wars. Like Hannibal won lots of wars against the Roman Empire, but as far as I know, he didn't actually win. So Israel has a bit of a Hannibal syndrome, maybe. It has to be very careful about what, if it will ever get to the end zone.
The politics of Rafah in particular, is that a factor for not only the Israeli government, but for the Israeli people? All those no's you pointed to, and there are more we could continue to talk about the college graduations that are now being damaged by the so-called pro-Palestinian faction. Does that weigh on the Israeli public to your reading, Seth?
I don't think the Israelis care at all about what's happening abroad because they are traumatized by the fact that 1,000 of them were murdered on October 7th and 132 are still held hostage. So I don't think they get up in the morning and worry about what a 19-year-old on a U.S. campus is doing. I don't, you know, of course they care about anti-Semitism abroad, but they hold Western countries and any country accountable for allowing anti-Semitism to thrive. And they probably know that this is being, you know, driven by a global agenda that's much bigger than just a few random students. There's a lot of other stuff going on. I think that there is a lot of domestic political disputes in Israel about what the best way to deal with this war. There's obviously a lot of people that think Israel should have done everything possible to get a hostage deal early on, or even now after 7 months, and bring home the living hostages, and that it's totally unacceptable to abandon, you know, hostages, elderly people, babies, women, soldiers. How can you leave them in the hands of a terrorist group? You should either do a deal or you should rescue them. So I think there's a huge part of the Israeli public that wants that to happen. They don't like the way the war is being run. They don't think the prime minister is necessarily waging it to get the hostages back, which is what they would like. And then you have, you know, different viewpoints on the far right or whatever in Israel that think that, you know, Israel shouldn't put a priority on that and should do a priority on other things. So there's a lot of things in Israel. I think that Israel has so many internal issues that just it cannot, it's too traumatized to think about whether or not, you know, there's a protest in Dublin tomorrow or in Los Angeles or whatever.
Seth Franzman of the Jerusalem Post and the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, Bill Raja of the FDD as well, the other war in the North when we come back. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.